After the release a few weeks back of Tashin's giant, physically giant, crypto art survey on NFTs, sparked just an absolute firestorm of exultation and cheer, and also outright despair, I knew it would be a detriment to this podcast if I didn't ask the curator and writer of that book, Mr. Robert Alice, to be on the podcast. I was desperate from the moment I saw the book's beautiful cover to know how this thing came together foundationally, how one even puts together a publication of this magnitude. I wrote at length on our Substack last week, museumofcrypto.substack.com, by the way, about why I think that this work, let alone any work that is so well-researched and thoughtful and clearly a labor of love, is worthy of our celebration. And this is a celebratory podcast. Colbert and I clearly agree, as you'll hear in the coming hour, that what Mr. Alice and Tashin have put together is something vital, new, and has a real chance of being as profoundly impactful as its makers clearly intended. But I want to note, especially if you were one of the people who were really critical of OnNFTs' curation and artist selection, that I am aware this is not an overly critical discussion, at least from my end. And that, while not explicitly my intention, resulted from the fact that Mr. Alice really seems to kind of get it. He goes into remarkable detail about the mechanisms of the book's creation, its decentralized curatorial strategy, and the realities of publishing a physical book about a digital art movement, and also why he made that decision in the first place. Even if you were spewing mad that you or someone you admire was not included in OnNFTs, I think you'll find in our conversation today that this book was the product of intensive research, awesome attention to detail, and real care about the substance of crypto art. Listening to Mr. Alice speak on the subject of his book and curation in general was a great joy, and I hope you find equal joy in it on this week's episode of Mocha Live. Welcome, everybody, to the Mocha Live podcast. It is 5 o'clock p.m. on the dot. We actually got here on time today. My name is Max Cohen. I'd like to welcome you, all of you, to the Mocha Live podcast. We have an awesome show for you today. I'm really excited. First, I'd like to introduce my co-host, as always. That's Mr. Colbert Bell, founder of the Museum of Crypto Art. Colbert, how are we finding you today?
Excellent. Thank you.
All right. Rock and roll. And then joining Colbert and I today, just a truly fascinating crypto art figure, an artist, a curator, man of the moment, in a sense. Yeah, I got to list a couple of your accolades, man. He was the first artist to sell an NFT, Portrait of a Mind, at a major auction house. Curated the first NFT auction at Sotheby's, natively digital. Maybe you remember it. I could go into your historical training and all the lectures you've given, but I'll spare you. And he was also the editor and writer of Tashin's On NFTs book. So Robert Alice, thanks for joining us. Welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you. We have a lot to get to today about Tashin, about your work as a curator, curation in general. So let's just start at the obvious place with that book behind your head. First of all, congratulations on that felt like a pretty monumental moment for crypto art in general. Colbert and I are on the record as being big fans. I was hoping you could talk a little bit about just, I mean, bringing this book together in a general sense, but also like how you approached the curation of 101 artists and like why you made the choice that the artists themselves would pick who wrote about them. Cause I thought that was a really fascinating and unique choice.
Oh, nice. So you've already been deep into it. That's cool.
We do our research on Mocha Live.
There's always a kind of question. Like if you look at how art history is written, you know, when you go to art school or study art history, which I did, your first year, you'll kind of present this text, called The Story of Art by Gombrich. And it's like this iconic kind of Bible that goes from Neolithic cave painting all the way through to Picasso. It's kind of like Gombrich is really like the kind of major sort of 20th century art historian. And, you know, it's a very like monolithic art history. It's Gombrich's voice and it's his view. And it kind of goes back to maybe a different time in terms of kind of art historical scholarship or like curation in general. You know, it was kind of the big alpha male white art historian, and they were going to tell you how art history was made, and it was their view, and they weren't going to include anyone else's point of view. And you know, increasingly, a lot of those histories are being kind of debunked to some extent. You know, there have been probably 5,000 books on Picasso. And only now are we starting to kind of really see him from a, you know, the kind of misogynistic point of view that he is. So, like, this is the kind of context. But effectively, the book on NFTs is really trying to bake in as many of the principles from the Web3 space. So things basically to do with kind of decentralization. Into the curatorial process for the book. You know, like, books, like, we should respect them, but only so much. And with history, there comes a huge responsibility, especially when you are laying out kind of like a primary history, of which this kind of is. I mean, there have been obviously books written on NFTs before, but not really at the scale of this. I mean, by a long way, this is the largest kind of historical study on NFTs. Really the first from a kind of major publishing house. And so it really did feel like kind of you're sort of laying down a primary history, like you're on the other side of a big book of blank pages, and there is just so much more amazing work than can ever be filled in it. Like, it gets filled really quickly. Like, it took 2.5 years to write, but it got filled very quickly. And so, yeah, it was really about kind of trying to figure out how you could tell a portrait of the NFT space that was fundamentally decentralized. And what that ultimately meant is, yeah, of course, like, my name is on the front of it, but really, like, it's, as you say, like a celebration of 100 writers, many more writers who wrote essays, and a very decentralized process towards kind of curation. You know, XCopy wrote like a couple of hours after the book was released. He was like, I've kind of figured out that, like, if you're in the book, you love it. If you're not, you hate it. And there's some of that, of course. You know, you can't get everyone in. And we can go on to talk about the kind of chaos and fragility of history, especially today. But ultimately, the kind of process was, we figured out, let's say, a group of like 20 artists that we thought was real historical consensus behind their work. Like, if anyone was going to pick up a pen and write a book, then these 20 artists would be in that list. And we went out and reached out to those artists. We said, hey, can you select 3 artists that you most admire? And that could be anyone and in the NFT space. And can you also then select 3 artists that you think are most overlooked? And that could be from like a gender point of view, an ethnicity point of view, a geographic point of view, or it could just be your mate down the road who has a studio next door and you just really vibe their work, but the rest of the world hasn't seen it yet. And so those 20 or 30 artists then gave us a list of 180. And then we repeated the same process. And we got to a list of like, I don't know, something like 700 or 800. And then you can start to see, I mean, in quite an analog way, you can start to see these kind of methods of consensus voting. Because basically any artist that came up 4 or 5 times, and people kept coming up from different places, right? It was kind of like building this kind of consensus network from different points where lots of artists would kept saying, you know, this name. And immediately, it doesn't matter if I liked their work, if I hated their work, it doesn't matter if I thought their work was important or not. Immediately, they went in. And that kind of got us to maybe probably 70 artists or something. And so, like, there are fundamentally artists in this book that whose work I don't like. And that's the point. Like, that's to be celebrated.
Like, who?
And who is that? That is a love. Is that a tiger?
Oh, no, this is a big cat.
Wow.
Yeah, he's a frequent guest on the podcast as well.
Sweet. Well, there are plenty of crypto kitties in this book too. Yeah. And then the last 30 artist spots, basically on that list, we, basically kind of re-went back onto that list and we asked 2 questions. We said, to what extent have you furthered the NFT space, like, or contributed to the NFT space? And that's on a kind of local and a global level. So, for example, like, There's a great NFT community in Nigeria. There's a great NFT community in Argentina and in Latin America. Parts of Latin America.
Shout out Osanachi, a friend, friend of the museum and all of our friends in Argentina.
Crypto.org.
And actually, those are parts of, like, you know, specifically talking about crypto art, the essay that Jason Bailey and Alex Estrick wrote, it's called On Crypto Art. They really talk about, you know, the subtitle is like the world's first global art movement, ? And so, you know, it doesn't matter if you were, you know, there's an artist called Rimbawan Guerrilla. No one's probably heard of him. He's an Indonesian artist who makes work about funerary rites in Indonesia. Mm-hmm. He has about, I can't quite remember, maybe 600, 800 followers on Twitter. But like, he's kind of an important player and like network builder in Indonesia.
What's his name, if you don't mind asking?
Rimbawan Guerrilla. I'll send it to you. You can put it in the show notes.
Tag it in the show notes.
And you know, like, Rimbawan underscores an important part that people forget of the NFT space, specifically of the crypto art movement, is that, you know, there's so much focus that's put on these artists that kind of do big sales, that work with these kind of prestigious brands, all this thing. But like, the true mission of NFTs is like, you can be an artist from anywhere in the world. You can build a small audience for yourself. You can have your work collected, and that can grow on a very open, flat cultural surface, which is the blockchain.
Mm.
And so it was really important, you know, to kind of spotlight all these different types and facets of the NFT ecosystem. So like, the most conceptually advanced kind of, or the most conceptually deep work, the most technically advanced work, but also work at all different scales of what like NFTs do. And that's fundamentally important. And I think somehow has been lost, you know, in the kind of the headlines of 2021 and 2022, is that like early promise of NFTs and what they're really about, which is not about the narrow concerns of an art world elite. It's like not about a small group of curators deciding who's in and who's out. It's not about big ticket sales. It's about actually opening up the world of art to whole new audiences that would never normally set inside a museum, allowing them to collect work at a reasonable price, and to follow an artist's career, whoever they may be. You know, in the introduction, I write that this is a history and a book about art at all levels, to all audiences, in all places, of all types. And that's really important. It's, you know, it's not about just selecting like the finest NFTs that have been made. It's about selecting all these different types that show all the different facets of the NFT space. So that final 30 was kind of filled up with kind of trying to portray the kind of like many different angles and kind of worlds in which the NFT space kind of operates in. And then the final question that we asked was, to what extent have you pushed forward the idea of an NFT? So like, what have you kind of developed on NFTs? Had you created new forms of NFTs? Had you worked with on-chain work? Had you kind of do all of these things that like really use NFTs as a medium? And that's basically how we got to the list. So yeah. Kind of in recap, very much consensus driven, community based. It was a very powerful lesson in the kind of in the power of decentralized co-curation. A lot of the artists in the book I didn't even know of before I started, and I would consider myself like an expert on the field even before I wrote the book. And then of course, like, yeah, as I said, kind of going through and asking like how had you contributed to the NFT space. And then also how had you kind of contributed to the idea of what an NFT is or could be. And I think the most important thing to say in all of that, which is, you know, we saw on Twitter as the book got released, which I think is kind of a testament to how important books still are, right? And how important history still is. You know, two concerns. One, like, we can go into it later, like, people are like, well, why do we need a history about a physical book or a history, you know, a history for NFTs? Like, it's all on the blockchain. Well, one, we can talk about later, but it's not. And two, it's kind of fundamentally important to say that like this book, the most important thing about this book, like, fine, the collector's edition, it weighs 14 kilos, it's huge, you probably need to get a reinforced coffee table to put it on the table. But like, when the trade edition comes out, it will go at a very affordable price compared to its competitors, because that's what Tashin's business model is. They produce these luxury, amazing, like hugely expensive, fabulous collector's books. But what that does is it finances the standard edition at a much lower price and at a much higher production value than what any of their competitors can do. And so when this book comes out in Q2 or Q3 of this year, it will go to every, you know, young artist, art historian, critic, every museum, every art bookshop, every art school, every university around the world. And the most important thing that will come out of this book is not for someone to kind of say, you know, Robert Alice, you got it perfectly right. Like, I wouldn't change a thing. The point is to say is like, actually, what is history? It's not the monolithic Gombrich story of art anymore. History and these books is a starting point for debate. And that's the most important thing about publishing. It is a declaration to say, if you think there's something wrong in here, if you think that there are other things to spotlight, take this book and use it as a starting point to go out and write your own. And then don't go and shitpost on Twitter. Commit 2.5 years of your life, which is what I did, and write the thing. Convince someone that you know your stuff well enough to go and get a book deal. And if not, go and publish it on the blockchain. And just like Rimbawan Guerrilla and any of the NFT artists that got found, if your stuff is good, it will get found. That's the most important thing.
I just want to ask you, like, you know, you made a choice to create this book as like a physical product, right? And of course, if you're going to make a physical product, you have to make these considerations that are going to leave you open to criticism, namely that you can only include so many artists because you only have so many pages because you have production costs, right? This book, if it were purely minted on the blockchain, could be, I don't know, 800, 900 pages. It could include a much larger survey of artistry. So it felt to me, seeing this, right, it's like this attempted middle ground where you're trying to be fresh for an audience of crypto art experts, but also super accessible to, like you said, these people in art schools, these people at the museums, right? You know, outside of just the book, if you were tasked with encapsulating crypto art to an audience that doesn't necessarily know anything about it, which you were, like, what were the points of emphasis that you wanted to hammer home? Obviously, we have the decentralization as the subtext, but like, what were these points that you wanted to hammer home and communicate to a world that is like point blank, just full of skeptics?
Yeah, of course. Well, I think, you know, firstly, to talk about this kind of the physicality of a book, you know, it's like this, I had a press interview with a Bloomberg reporter who, you know, as soon as I jumped on the call, I just realized, like, you know, this guy is baying for blood. And there is nothing I can do to, there's no point in me even trying to change his opinion. You're just like swimming against the wrong tide. And at the end of the article that came out today, he writes, you know, what a shame it is that there's a physical, it's like a regression for the blockchain to have a physical publication. And it's like, I didn't really understand. I thought it was quite a lazy point of view. It's like, well, you know, should the biography, you know, should Walter Isaacson's biography of Steve Jobs only be on iOS? Like, you know, should any history of social media only be published on Facebook? You know, books have existed for thousands of years. They have a habit of sticking around, right? Blockchains will, I hope, stick around. But these books will also stick around, but they also circulate in very different spaces. And everyone's had that feeling of picking up a book. If you can read, you've had that feeling. And it's come from the earliest point that you can read. You have a feeling of sitting down and sinking into a book. And time slows down. And your mind opens up. And your ability to consider things is fundamentally different from reading a 99-point thread on Twitter, right? Like, if we want to slow down and really consider, like, what we've achieved over the last 5 or 10 years, then picking up a book and slowly leafing through it and kind of contextually moving from spread to spread rather than from some weird hyperlink to another hyperlink and getting distracted in the middle. Like, that's what books offer. And then for the general public, they offer a very kind of comfortable abstraction into a digital realm that they may not feel comfortable with. everyone feels comfortable with books, right? Everyone respects books to some extent. Like as I said, I think we should respect books, but only so much. And for the general public, like this is a kind of important stepping stone into the NFT space. You know, a lot of the work that I've made as an artist has always been a kind of digital and physical thing. In many ways, the Tashin book is a kind of encapsulation of that. And it's these crossover projects that link these worlds together. That's the intersection that I'm interested in. So that's just a couple of kind of like insights on the physicality of the book and why that's important to me personally. And then, you know, regarding kind of curation and this idea of like, what is crypto art and how do we kind of define it? Well, you know, the beauty that you have is the influence that you have as an editor, you get to choose. I also got to choose who to write on certain subjects. And it was pretty much a no-brainer to ask Jason Bailey and Alex Esterick, who works with them now at Right Click Save, to write this essay on crypto art. And you know, as a kind of editor, in which it's definitely not my perspective, but it's about bringing people in with different perspectives, I can only really kind of parrot what they really talked about, which is this idea that and we've touched on it a little bit, is that this idea of like crypto art is very much a reaction. I mean, it follows many of the same lines as the crypto story more widely does, right? It's very much a reaction against a kind of elite. It's very much, you know, it's interesting to see that the kind of blockchain and maybe the wider NFT space came up in an age of populism. I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that in a kind of good way, actually. And that crypto art is again about, it's about art at all levels, to all audiences, of all types and all places. I think that kind of sums it up, really. Mm-hmm. It's about a celebration of a direct link between an artist and a collector, unmediated by someone else's opinion. And yeah, that has the potential for, you know, the art world has always been, well, it's been victim to two things, right? It's been victim, firstly, to the fact that physical production only extends so far, i.e. like how many, like if you were going to make an edition of something, like how many really make an edition of, like even the biggest artists in the world probably like max out at the edition of 1,000. Pac sold 30,000 NFTs in 2 minutes to 30,000 art buyers around the world. Fine, in a very speculative moment, but people forget that. Like it underscored maybe the future potential that you as an artist could sell 30,000 NFTs, generative NFTs that are fundamentally different and unique to each collector for $1 rather than one work for 30,000. Mm-hmm. And maybe at that point, open up the same kind of audiences that music's opened up, right? Because the distribution method is fundamentally different, that film has opened up, right? And to do it in a way where it's not geographically located, like you don't have to go to the new museum around the corner from where I'm staying today to go and see art. And that I think is like the true promise of kind of crypto art. But also, like, I don't know. I mean, Jason and Alex like talk in the chapter very much about this idea that crypto art was a kind of period rather than a movement. And really it was a period around the very early moments of kind of the NFT space. So thinking about kind of the rare Pepe cards, like the rare Pepe wallet, what that really meant as a kind of sales platform, and then how like Super Rare at the beginning was a kind of crypto art platform, and then it became a kind of invitation only place, and that was like kind of almost the beginning of the end of crypto art, and it existed for a short period of time in a world that was quite nascent before there was a huge amount of market pressure and kind of corporate insight into the NFT space. And so it's a kind of interesting perspective.
Well, let me just stop you there, because I want to just hit on that topic briefly, because I think it's fascinating. And it's also the point, I think, of a lot of tension in the kind of the subtext of what crypto art culture is talking about, right? I think there's like a reaction that we're seeing constantly today to this assertion that crypto art, as we know it, is kind of ceased, and we are now in some kind of like digital art on the blockchain era. Colbert, I'm curious, like, what do you think about that dichotomy? Like, do you think that there's truth in this, you know, assertion that like crypto art as a movement is ended and that like we're kind of still like forming something else?
No, I just think that the pendulum always swings, right? So for, you know, the Web 2 era, artists were relegated to creating content for platforms to attract followers, to go sell prints. And that ballooned, right, with people. He was like the epitome of, if you have X number of followers, then you can go sell down to those followers because NFTs are the hot new thing. You know, before that, yes, it was crypto art, but we're going to be doing this like give and take of art on the blockchain, returning to crypto art, sending it back. And that's okay as long as the encapsulation of the movement continues to grow and spread in the same way that blockchain adoption will continue to grow and spread. It's just kind of inevitable. And these things ultimately converge. So what is crypto art? Well, it's always going to be that one individual who is empowered to bring their art into a global market and, you know, free of any other influence and followers. There's also somebody else out there who is receiving that energy and sharing and connecting with that work.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I think it is interesting, you know, I was speaking a lot recently about, you know, people ask like, why is the book not called On Digital Art? And, you know, in many ways, like this first moment, that first chapter for NFTs, which really the book explores, which is, I mean, 2014 to 2021, really it moves a bit into 22 and 23. Mm-hmm. But really that kind of first chapter for the NFT space. And, you know, even today there's this kind of, you know, NFTs are fundamentally just a technology, like they're agnostic, you can do anything you like with them. And then we saw in the media and in the kind of way that the NFT space was portrayed was like this collapsing of all these different types of NFTs into this kind of one pool, right? So you would have gaming tokens and metaverse land parcels and like avatar projects under the same term or terminology as like important works of art. And maybe over time, you know, we're kind of constantly talking about how the blockchain is going to get abstracted away. And maybe over time, like the term NFT will get abstracted away and it will move into this idea of digital art. And I think at the same time, like, you know, crypto art, you know, a lot of the like the association with crypto art, and you know, Jason and Alex do talk about it, is specifically in those kind of very early days in which like there was a kind of community of artists or kind of technologists come artists who were making work that was specifically kind of to do on a narrative basis about crypto. And now that I disagree with that as like the kind of real meaning of the term crypto art, but it has come to kind of mean that to some extent. And so, you know, there is a conversation to be had about, you know, taking the same principles from all these things, but thinking about like, what is the future terminology that really kind of allows people to kind of join that movement in a way that they don't necessarily like feel like they have to associate either with the crypto movement itself or the NFT kind of blockchain movement. And there's a question to be had there. I don't know. I mean, it'd be interesting to hear what you guys think about it.
Yeah, I mean, the question I'm always thinking of, or like constantly think of, is like, can crypto art continue even? Can crypto art as a set of ideals and even aesthetic principles continue if the dominant form of cultural exchange in the blockchain is not necessarily crypto art? Like, yeah, you know, I think this idea that crypto art has ended is false. And I don't, like, that's just kind of more of a feeling that I have because I see so many people who are constantly like carrying that torch loudly and proudly. And yet, I see more and more of this work that is on the blockchain being somewhat uninterested in engaging with crypto tenants or, you know, tenants of globalized decentralization, or just kind of being reverent to the building blocks of this movement. I mean, maybe that's like a bit abstract of a statement, but
no, I mean, I agree. I think it's, you know, we're definitely in this moment of like shift, you know, like I think there was this huge explosion. There's been a moment of reflection, which is fundamentally where this book came out of. And, you know, as kind of, well, the crypto markets start moving again, there's definitely going to be a sense of energy that gets re-engaged into it. And we'll see what kind of comes out of that. But yeah, I don't think there's one dominant like idea of what crypto art is. I think maybe that's almost part of the definition. You know, it can be like a plurality of things, to a plurality of different people. In many ways, to try and define it as one single thing then means that it becomes the kind of one dominant idea that is not fundamentally decentralized. Right. One of the things we do in the book, there's a chapter at the beginning. It's called NFTs Are. NFTs Are dot, dot, dot. And we basically went around and we asked a bunch of people to define what they thought NFTs are. And it came on the back, the front cover of that chapter was like the Merriam-Webster definition for what NFTs actually are, right? But what you realize is that actually when you survey the community, and there was like maybe 200 statements. I mean, it ranges. Like I can probably get it up and read you a few of them because they're kind of funny. NFTs are trains to transformation, mind the gap. NFTs are transitory. NFTs are too boring to merit a book. NFTs the urinal of the 21st century. NFTs are time capsules buried in every garden. NFTs are financial care collapsed into expressive protocols. NFTs are a swing state. NFTs are just a usual tool for digital artists. NFTs are surveillance capitalism's greatest hack. I wonder who wrote that. Colbin Dotty.
Was that me?
Yeah.
Oh, God, amazing.
NFTs are the ultimate fetish object. NFTs are digital oxygen for degens. NFTs are the future religious artifact. So, you know, just survey the world and there are 1,000 different definitions for what these things mean. Like fundamentally, it's going to shift and change. And I think to accept that is kind of part of the definition of it. Specifically like on the blockchain, which is again, this very kind of flat, permissionless space. It's never going to be one kind of like monolithic definition.
Yeah, I'm toying in my head the going back and the idea of appeal and something we keep talking to and kind of the emergence of these Web2 applications in which we were bringing ourselves online. We were throwing our identity into boxes. And for 10 plus years, we had crystallized that. And then, you know, in the pandemic, old routines were broken, this idea of identity. And then there was kind of suddenly an expectation that we needed to shift and change and become kind of a multiplicity of things. And I think at the individual level, as that is occurring, it's also happening at the institutional level. And what I like about the work that we do within the museum is we can just as easily go like with Filecoin, form a partnership, go build a huge curation tech stack, allow people to, you know, upload exhibitions into the metaverse just as we can shitpost online. And that fluidity of the idea of institution, the fluidity of the and permission for the individual to continue to change over time and be dynamic, I think is a major break in the idea that you need to be in a system when you can be in kind of like a multiplicity of places, times, events, things in these digital worlds.
Yeah, I agree. I'm just looking to see... I'm just looking through the book actually.
Well, I just if I can add just real quick, like
of course.
You know, I think so many of the artists who are admired the most in the space are those who can merge these different versions of themselves into singular pieces. And so you can see both of them. I think that's a huge reason why a lot of money remains this like patron saint of crypto art, that like you can't avoid the high and the low influences, the like multiplicities of that person's personality in the work. I think it's why someone like Mohara continues to like be this just kind of like North Star figure. Colburn used North Star to describe a lot of money, so all kudos to you for the terminology. Someone like Matt Cain, who is like constantly subverting expectations and creating this art that is both like incredibly, incredibly technically precise and also kind of like has some, at least his recent work has some like real shit posty qualities to it.
Yeah.
Like, I think when you can do both of those things, people respond to that.
Yeah, I think so. I think one of the first, like, there are these big gatefold spreads in the book, which, like, basically these spreads that, like, they're almost like double pages, they open out. The first gatefold spread is gatefold spread of like all is, I think it's 127, or I can't remember exactly how many, but like every single ether rock, you know, it's like 1.4 meters of ether rocks, like printed in this like Tashin book, you know, and it's like, how did we get here? This is hilarious. But it underscores the importance of meme and humor to the NFT space. And that shouldn't be lost in all of this. You know, it's like this book published by Tashin, like it takes itself quite seriously. It should, because it's a serious subject. But like, it also takes itself like with a pinch of salt, you know? Yeah. I'm just looking here, actually. The opening quote is quite a beautiful quote for the On Crypto Art essay. And I just read it. Before my father, we're talking about Charles Chuck Suozzi, who's an artist who made a couple of NFTs before he died. Before my father passed away, when he found out about NFTs and the fact that people were suddenly interested in an artistic movement that had already been happening for 60 years, he actually wept. He was so emotionally overcome with the fact that this was finally coming to fruition. For all those years, the art world never took it seriously. And now, like it or not, NFTs have given that whole movement credibility through provenance and making art less elitist. Mm. And so, you know, there's another kind of interesting storyline to the idea of like, what is crypto art? It's about looking back at digital art history of the last 60 years. And this kind of through line that connects this whole kind of world that before was just completely disenfranchised from the art market. And, you know, a lot of people say, you know, where did this all come from? You know, how have these markets erupted? Maybe we're just seeing, you know, if you think about the fact that, like, you know, art and the things that have cultural value are supposed to be an index of what is culturally important today. We spend 80% of our time online. Like, we spend a huge amount of our lives, almost all our life, mediated by technology. And yet, like, up until like the 2010s, people were still making paintings. Like, do you know what I mean? It's like, it's kind of anachronistic. Like, it's weird. And those were like the most important cultural goods of our time, right? And they were the things that were most valued. And so maybe like what we're not seeing is like this explosion of this new world. Like, maybe we're just seeing like a great rebalancing that should have started a long time ago of the importance of like digital art on the kind of cultural stage.
Well, I mean, I would argue that perhaps there was just a shift in the cultural consciousness that did not use the terminology of the art world and was not and because of that was not necessarily absorbed by like the quote unquote like capital A art world. You know, I just finished playing The Last of Us Part Two, and those were two games that came out in the 2010s that were incredibly highly selling, that were lauded for storytelling, the artistry that like went into creating these games. And I think that feels so much more like a dominant cultural object of the period than like a painting or even any given artwork. I think if you asked me to name an artwork period that was created between 2010 and 2016, right? And, you know, and if I weren't, you know, as locked into crypto art as I was, we can extend that timeline further. It's things like that, these bits of cultural affectation that were not at the time and probably still would not be classified as like capital A art. So I wonder if there was just a kind of reevaluation of what the general public was considering to be art and high artistry that just flew under the radar because nobody was using the terminology. Nobody was treating the thing as a capital A artwork because it was a different medium, because it had maybe more commercial, like blatantly commercial. Intentions. Maybe.
I mean, I think there's a few things to say to that. Like, one, actually, when I was thinking about, as you kindly pointed out, I've done a number of different projects in the NFT space, and as 2021 kind of closed, 21 closed, I was thinking, you know, what is the next kind of, what's the next thing? And the beauty of the NFT space is that there's just so much open territory to explore, right? Mm. You know, we kind of talked about writing the 5,000th book on Picasso. Like, does it really move the needle? I mean, it does to some extent, like his oeuvres and like characters being reassessed, but like, does it really, like, you know, the beauty of writing a book on NFTs is like, it really does move the needle. Like, it's a big step forward, you know? So I went out and I spoke to Marlene Natasha and kind of, she was interested, and then she said, oh, you know, you should go and speak to my father, who's Bernard Tashin, who set up the publishing house. He's a very important art collector. One of the world's kind of leading leading experts on contemporary art. And I went out to LA, where he's based, and he kind of lives in this amazing home called the Chemosphere, which is designed by John Lotner. It's kind of known as one of the most modern houses in the world. It looks like a UFO buried into the Hollywood Hills. And I went there, and he kind of owns half the hill, and the bottom house that he owns is a library that's kind of filled sky high with every book. He's crazy. It's like most intimidating interview context that you've had. Like, these are my books. I've written them. I know what I'm doing. And we sat down, and you know, it was really interesting. He kind of, it's a family business, and they take personal relationships very seriously. That's how they publish. Like, it's about their personal relationships with people. Like, they publish people, not books. That's what they say. And so we sat down, and like, for like 2 hours, we just like talked art. And I just remember at the beginning, we were talking, just at your point, it's a slight tangent, we were talking about, I was mentioning this important auction of contemporary art. It was the first kind of major evening sale for contemporary art in the 70s. And it was called the Skull Auction. And it was famously where Robert Rauschenberg punched Skull, who was a New York taxi magnate, for selling his work and taking all the money, right? And he was like, I sold that for people. Anyway, it's a kind of famous moment, and underscores a lot of kind of, I think, what NFTs ended up coming to try and re-engineer before they kind of failed when OpenSea, when everyone realized that actually it's not hard-coded as much into the smart contracts as everyone thought. But anyway, I kind of said this to him, and he very quickly came back to me. I said, oh, it was in 1971. He came back to me as quick as a fish. He said, I think you'll find it's 1974. And I was like, oh, okay, we're away at the races here. Like, this guy knows what he's talking about. And it's like, we're in the big leagues here. So you know, you can't be fudging your dates anymore. And we went deep we went for lunch every day. He said, we're going, we took a 2-hour conversation deep on NFTs. The guy went really deep. And every lunch, I booked flights to leave that evening. I had to get to Art Basel, Miami. And he was like, oh, tomorrow we meet the same time, same place. We're going deeper, another 2 hours. I had to go and buy a whole new set of clothes, make another 200 NFT presentation, rebook my flights, and go back for lunch the next day. And we did this for like 4 days or something. It was just ridiculous. But it underscores kind of the level of rigor, I think, in the book. And, you know, the other side is like, it's a slight tangent, but this Skull Auction was like an important moment for the art market. And, you know, when we think about kind of crypto art and the NFT space, it is fundamentally like about a market. And that just hadn't existed before. There's a great essay in the book called On Collecting. And it's all about the history of collecting. And basically what you realize when you really study it is that the history of art is also the history of the disruption of finance. Mm-hmm. And by that, I mean, like, no one really remembers the Medicis in the Renaissance period as the inventors of two-way accounting and like the basis of modern capitalism. But everyone remembers them as patrons of the arts. And no one really remembers the Rothschilds as like one of the first European banking families, but everyone remembers them as patrons of the arts. And then the industrialists in America move in, you have the Rockefellers and the Guggenheims. Again, same thing. And then you had this kind of Web 2 movement, which was all about sharing and social networks. And actually, it was really interesting that those, you know, all the galleries went down to San Francisco, set up galleries, and they never really got that value capture from collectors. Like, there wasn't really this like collecting vibe. But then crypto came around. And like, if you own Bitcoin, you are a collector. Like, If you own Ethereum, you are a collector. If you own any crypto asset or token, you are a collector. Like, that's effectively what you are doing. And so it became no surprise that it became very fertile ground for this, like, this market to be built. And also no surprise that those people wanted to build that kind of cultural image in there, the kind of culture in their image, right, to reflect their shared values. And so what you're seeing is a very different reference set to what normally constitutes the art world. You're seeing, you know, the importance of science fiction. You're seeing the importance of gaming. You're seeing the importance of all these kind of things, you know, tradability, all these kind of things, traits, rarities. That comes out of, you know, that world. And so actually the history of digital art, you know, kind of got united with this kind of crypto history, this destruction of finance, this long arc of the history of collecting. And I think that's kind of where, like, where we've ended up today, like, and kind of the reason that the NFTs and kind of crypto art kind of met its audience. Like, it is simply a reflection of the fact that the new decentralized, the new elite, to some extent, will be this kind of decentralized class. You know, in a way that hopefully is kind of, you know, when, like, when Metacoven bid for the Beeple, what he saw in that work was a proof of work. That's what he liked. Proof of work of getting up every day and making a work for 15 years. Like, love Beeple or hate him, like, you wake up every day and make a work of art for 15 years. And I can guarantee you, it's not fake. Like, I walked around Venice, the Venice Biennale with him, and at about 4 o'clock, he started getting itchy, and he kept saying, I need to get home. I need to go back to my hotel to take my portrait or make my portrait. I'm thinking, like, I just got a photography shoot or something like that. Like, someone come and take his portrait or something. No, he was going back. He was going back to his hotel to make that work of art. It was a proof of work, 15 years. And so all these themes, like, run through it. And that was the moment that really, like, NFTs kind of got escape velocity. And so, but it was remade in the image of someone that really, like, liked that. And so we cannot really separate the market from the circulation of art. Like, they're just, like, fundamentally tied together. They always have been. And to kind of say that they haven't is, like, is just kind of what gallerists have said to kind of perpetuate their place in the cycle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's so much more to say there on, like, you know, the history of speculation, the importance of speculation to the idea of NFTs, the importance of trade to it, like, go deep on it. I know we're at 50 minutes now. So
I was going to say, maybe next time.
More kind of questions or kind of things that we want to focus on.
So why don't I just jump in really quick and say, you know, I got to the Tashin opening a bit late, and there was first of all, the energy outside was absolutely electric, right? Oh, everybody was like clamoring to get in. There was a line that stretched around like two Paris city blocks. People waited, and it was raining.
It was, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, and I couldn't believe it, right? So Cosmo saw me, grabbed me, brought me in.
He was doing his job.
Yeah, super, super kind.
I'm glad.
And then, like, this massive bookstore in the heart of Paris, packed to the gills, and the book itself is, like, I had to squirm my way to the front to see it. Exceptionally gorgeous.
Just thank you.
Stunning. And flipped through maybe the first 100 pages, the print quality, the steel.
It really
case,
is amazing, isn't it? It's a craft in of itself. Wow.
It is a beautiful, beautiful thing. So I just want to, and obviously, you know, I've been very marginally alongside you for the 2.5 years. To get
you're
here.
In the book.
And Yeah. It's I think a monumental accomplishment. It takes 2 minutes to write a criticism online, but it very clearly took all of 2.5 years to produce what you have produced. So we're just grateful for.
No, I mean, I think that's, you know, it's. I mean, that was the most meaningful thing. I'm so sorry we couldn't get to chat on the night, but that was the most meaningful thing about, you know, there's. You know, working with these kind of like prestigious places, and there's like all the fun and excitement of doing the actual work, and then there's all the kind of glamour of the evening. But like, what really matters is your peers coming up to you and saying, you know, whose work they've entrusted you with, and saying, wow. Like, and that is the most meaningful thing. You know, it's like hugging people that I've worked with for the last 2 years or 3 years that I've never met in person, and then just being like blown away by it all. And then, you know, as a shout out to Tashin, like, you know, as you said, like the print quality is unbelievable. I mean, there's a reel that I just put up on Twitter, which kind of goes, we went to Verona for a couple of days to do a lot of the proofing of the colors, and a lot of the kind of the final production of the book. And you kind of get this understanding, like, you know, it's a nice way to finish maybe, but in the introduction, we talk about the importance of text to NFTs and how NFTs are, when you boil it down, just text, right? They're code, a hyperlink to a decentralized file server, this on-chain work, like NFTs are just text. You don't have to look any further than like Lava Labs autoglyphs to understand that like texts are written like code. They're not drawn in a way. And, you know, the other insight is that like blockchains are just the latest breakthrough in the history of publishing. Like, you know, a lot of people said like goes Gutenberg's printing press and now the blockchain. And so it's interesting how these kind of these long arcs, like, you know, this history of publishing, creating a book, and then going to Verona and seeing this printing press working, right? And it really feels like a blockchain. Like, it really feels like new blocks are being minted when these pages get put out. And you get this real sense of, like, the history of publishing and how the blockchain gets tied into it. And it was kind of fascinating. But, you know, in all of it, like, to have the kind of, have your peers, and not just artists, you know, like, the book, as we've talked about right at the beginning, is a survey of, you know, 100 artists, 100 writers, 450 stakeholders and contributors, you know, from all different facets of the NFT space. And it's a testament and a portrait of a world that, like, yeah, artists are to some extent in the center of it or get more of the limelight, but there are important collectors, critics, art historians, technologists, builders, platforms, and all of that constitutes like the NFT ecosystem. And without any one part of it, the whole ecosystem falls down. And so it really is like a kind of total portrait of that. And, you know, Coben, for all you've done in the NFT space, you know, you're rightfully in there in multiple places. And it's just kind of nice to share that history with as many people as possible. It's been fun.
Well, as we say in my neck of the woods, Mazel Tov on NFTs, man. Yeah, the book is on NFTs, Robert Alice and Tashin. I am very much looking forward to the paperback version.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
Looking forward to hearing more about that. Thank you so much for all of your insight. This was a fascinating conversation. Thank you, Colborn, for your insight as well. This is an intimidating duo to hear you guys go back and forth. And thanks everyone for listening. If you liked what you heard today, please give us a subscribe and a follow on whatever podcast app you use, because Twitter will otherwise diminish us to the point of rubble. Please give us a follow on Substack if you want to see some writing. That's museumofcrypto.substack.com. Please check out Robert Alice. Please check out On NFTs, Tashin. And we appreciate you being with us. Robert, any last words before we kick off?
If anyone's in New York, Max, you're in New York. What are you doing tomorrow? What are you doing on Friday night? Your plans?
You're going to the Tashin Book Show. You're
going to the opening. Basically, I'm doing, I've got an auction on next Tuesday, 400 generative works that kind of have been inspired by the book, but it marks the US launch of Tashin's On NFTs. So yeah, if you are, I don't know when this will come out, but if you are if you've got nothing to do on Friday night in New York, come and share a glass of champagne with us at Christie's. Mark the US launch. So yeah, Max, do come. It'd be lovely to have you there. I'll make sure I'll add your name to the RSVP list and bring a couple of pals.
I hosted a whole podcast and all I got was an invitation to a book launch at Christie's, put on a t-shirt. Well, thanks, man. I appreciate that. And I appreciate both of you very much. I appreciate everyone listening. And we'll be back next week. More Mocha Live. Take care, everybody.
Thanks so much, guys. Cheers. Cheers.
This podcast was edited and produced by me, Max Cohen. It would not have been possible, as always, without the guidance and participation of my stalwart co-host, Mr. Colborne Bell. We would like to extend a huge thanks to Robert Allis for providing us with such a cavalcade of insight in his appearance today. And we'd like to thank as well Mr. Julian Brangold for his intro and outro music, and Day Fox for composing our cold open theme. And thanks as always to you for listening. We hope to see you next week on the next Mocha Live podcast.